everybody. Today is August 23rd, a Saturday. And what you're going to hear today is a supplemental show. Carlos and I did an episode of our shows together with a young man named Dana, who dropped out of school and is currently traveling the country. So we had just kind of an informal chat for about an hour and a half. I cut it down to around 50 minutes, and I thought some of you might enjoy this. And check out Carlos's YouTube channel if you want to see the full version with lots of additional rants and cursing. It's all there. Up next, Behold a Dictator Part 2 with Thaddeus Russell. We recorded that yesterday. I'll have that to you as soon as possible. And before we get to the show, I want to say a huge thanks to Darren. He purchased something for us off the School Socks Amazon wish list. It is the Zoom H4 Handy Recorder. Now, I can go and do podcasts anywhere. Before, I had this mobile setup that involved a USB mic, and those days are over, folks. Now I have this thing. It's like a portable, tiny little mixer. And if I want to, I can bring XLR mics and plug them in. Or I can just put this thing right down on the table. It has two built-in mics that are pretty decent. I've heard some of the recordings done with the Zoom. And I can go do locations at events. I can go do interviews. It's always better to do face-to-face. So the Zoom, which is in my hand right now, that's the thing I'm hitting, is a phenomenal gift. So thank you very much, Darren. We have an Amazon wish list. You can check it out. It's in the support tab, drop-down menu at schoolsocksproject.com. All right, let's get to the conversation. We're going to start it already in progress. And I'll talk to you again soon. I was the last one there and I heard his song.
There was something from nothing that nothing could hold. I grew up with a bunch of people around my life who did not take the normal route. My mother actually dropped out of high school when she was younger, and she went to real estate, and she actually founded her own company recently for aerospace and defense recruiting. So she was one of the people in my life who taught me that you don't need to have a high school education to be successful. And also, like, you have to know what success means to you so you can go and achieve that.
So I'm dying to know what Dana does.
So you're a male stripper, right?
Not quite.
Close, though.
Almost, yeah. Mm. While we're traveling, me and my girlfriend are actually both models for different agencies. And while we aren't walking we're not doing fashion shows or anything, we actually work at just different events, such as concerts or different corporate events, different type of festivals downtown. So if there's any company down there that needs people to represent them, the company will contact an agency, which we are affiliated with, and the agency will contact us to go represent that company. But we've worked a lot in Ohio. Specifically, we've worked for Donate Life in Columbus. We've worked for Buick in Cleveland. And things like that.
So yeah, I met you originally when I was speaking at Liberty Fest in North Carolina, and you were stating, oh, well, I just came from this other spot. And then you sent me this message. It was like, yeah, I just spent a month in Canada, and today I was just, you know, we're over at the White Mountain, you know, tenting, doing other crazy shit that people, you know, basically save 3 years worth of money in order to be able to do. Now, of course, in your particular case, you have been able to market something that you necessarily did not work for, in the sense of you have facial symmetry, which is cool, but there's obviously other ways by
mathematics
which,
is on my side.
Yeah. But whenever we're looking at things like high school dropouts, there's obviously people who went different routes. You have David Karp, who founded Tumblr at 15 and became a billionaire. Richard Branson, who is the CEO of Virgin, is doing more for business than simply taking government handouts. You also have, by the way, he's worth $4.6 billion. You have Mike Hoddock, a product manager for Facebook and founder of Blip.tv. Kirk Kerkorian, who owns Vegas, pretty much. And in the internet age, there's no supposed secret knowledge to be found in remedial high schools or shit colleges. I mean, there never was really secret knowledge in the past, but still, now that's coming to light. And then you have folks like Peter Thiel, who is, you know, paying entrepreneurs to get out of college and is the backer of what may be, outside of Bitcoin, the greatest leap forward in getting us out of the state, which is seasteading.
Yeah. With the internet, you can access the archive of, like, all of human knowledge. And with that, there is no such thing as like occulting. So
yeah, so there's two reasons why college used to mean a lot more, and finishing high school was obviously the ticket to getting there. The first one is like you said, there was no real hidden knowledge, but college definitely kept certain sets of knowledge more protected from, you know, the ordinary folks.
Sure, more in the shadows.
Right. And of course, the other reason is that everybody is told to go to college now. So if everybody has a college degree,
does it really mean?
Absolutely nothing. But no, when it comes to that particular case, you know, when it comes to companies like Google, for instance, who's mm-hmm. right now the biggest corporation, one of the most successful corporations in history, you have them actually picking up people who don't even have high school diplomas because they're thinking, well, you know, if he's 16 years old, he hasn't wasted a bunch of his time doing a menial task for his computer science teacher that doesn't lead to any single thing productive. Instead, he's kind of pushing his way forward to be able to understand more.
Yeah, and without a degree, you definitely have to represent yourself more. So if you go to a company, you don't have a degree, and they're actually considering hiring you, you really have to present your case more, and you have to demonstrate your knowledge in a much more profound way. And if you can do that, that will leave an impression on the employer.
Brett, let me ask you something real quick. Whenever mm-hmm. you've been doing your basically your more normal jobs, have they ever asked for the actual transcripts to your college?
No one has ever asked for anything.
Yeah, that's the
wait. No, I apologize. In 2011, I got a job working with a tutoring company, and there was a tutoring company called Club Z, and I was just working with them part time. But most of this company had been built up around serving the state, serving the public schools. And they were very bureaucratic because of that, because they had sort of taken on all of the public school busy work paperwork. So the woman said, yeah, we're going to need to get a photocopy of your college degree. Now, I graduated from college in the year 2000. I was like, yeah, I don't think I can help you there. I don't know where, I have no idea where that would be. I haven't seen it in 9 or 10 years. And she's like, your college degree is not hanging on your wall? Like she was very proud of hers as a, you know, maybe a public school educator who was running this company or working for this company in her spare time. I did wind up finding it. It had fallen apart and it had accumulated a bit of mildew, but I found it in a box in my mom's basement. And now I have it at the bottom of a box at my residence. So it's not in my mom's basement anymore.
Well, it's really interesting, though, because and I have to kind of like explain this to some people, because I had a few friends who dropped out of high school and they're like, oh, I can't go to get a job because I don't have a high school degree. I was like, they don't ask for your high school degree. Just check off the fucking box.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you like if I go into a job and I've went into a few. I worked for, you know, a hospital and other things. The only job that ever asked me for my college transcript was Child Protective Services. Mm-hmm. And that was it. And honestly, that shit would have been easy as hell to fake.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing is like, you're going to go spend $300,000 in certain cases, right? And mm-hmm. all this time and effort and everything else to show something that you don't even necessarily need.
Right.
Right. And that,
and you
that
might not be learning as in-depthly as you're led to believe as well, whatever you're studying.
No, you're not. There was one class, it was actually the history of education in America. And the guy told us about how awesome of a drummer he was. And he would like complain about his garden. He mentioned like Horace Mann like once. He's like, he was this cool guy. You know, he wanted to set up education in America. Never mentioned the Prussians. Never mentioned basically the state we're in right now.
The progressives.
No. Oh my God. Progressives.
Context.
No, not at all. He's like, and then Dewey came along, made it more cool. And it's cool. I like education. It's like, you do, because you're a tenured university professor.
And you're choosing to be ignorant.
Yeah.
Two things came to mind.
All right.
The first one is this fantasy of me being a college professor, but also a really good drummer. And I sit in the classroom at the drums. And every time I say something that's really great, I say correct. And I lay down a little beat. Two, I used to work as a recruiter. I would get paid by filling these jobs. I was a technical recruiter. So it was mostly engineering jobs, power plant jobs. And everybody had to have a college degree. But most of the best engineers came up at a time where college degrees weren't necessary to get started or to push a career forward. So I would find some guy who had, you know, had been working since 1970. His credentials, his resume was 4 or 5 pages. His credentials were amazing. And we couldn't even look at him because the company wouldn't take him if he didn't have a college degree. So there's all these great people who are looking mostly for contract work, but are actually having trouble finding it now, overqualified, if anything, because of new hiring standards. And there was a Supreme Court case in the early 70s. It was an employment discrimination case called Griggs versus Duke Power that I think I have it right. I pulled it up. Griggs versus Duke Power. And they were using other sort of metrics for determining whether or not people were employable. People had the skills that they needed. Apparently, Duke Power got in trouble for supposedly discriminating. So more employers shifted to using the college degree as a more objective standard.
Well, they actually made it illegal to do intelligence, specific intelligence tests before getting a job, because they said it was discriminatory practices. It was like, yeah, you're discriminating against stupid people. Good job. And they were actually trying to make the argument that it was racist, right? Because holding people from multiple races to the same standards
that
is racist.
That itself is a racist statement.
No, no shit. It's like, oh, well, we need to give... And, you know, there's some... I'm trying to remember whether or not it was actually found to be true, but in specific high schools, they were trying to make, like, certain parameters for different races as far as, like, okay, well, if you're of the black race, then you have to take an easier test. At the same time, throwing around the message that race doesn't exist.
Here's the finding or the judgment, if you're interested. The Supreme Court ruled under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, if such tests disparately impact ethnic minority groups, businesses must demonstrate that such tests are reasonably related to the job for which the test is required.
And Stefan Molyneux was bringing this up in his recent comments in regards to defending Adam Carolla from the Young Turks, but essentially it was... This woman was suggesting that because so-called libertarians, as the word she was using, and conservatives are essentially against education because we don't want it to be insanely funded by everyone. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, well, you know, there's all these other parameters. And why should people have to wait till they're 22 to be able to get a actual job? Like, that's the insanity of it. I met freshmen. They're like, oh, man, professor didn't show up today. So that means I can skip class. This is awesome. I'm like, you're paying for it. You just paid an asshole like $300 for him not to show up.
Doesn't feel like you're paying for it when you're there.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I had no problem sleeping through. Like, I remember having classes at 9:30 and coming from high school and being like, I don't have a class until 9:30 in the morning. And then 2 weeks later of the college environment, I was like, I cannot believe I have to get up at 9:30. Yeah. But I had no problem sleeping through a 9:30 class because it didn't feel, it was, you know, they weren't, you know, taking money at the door to the classroom.
Right.
That's a very valid point. And it's funny is whenever you go to college, there's multiple classes that you have to take in order to be able to get a degree, right? So you're a well-rounded student, supposedly. None of them are finance. None of them are personal finance, economics, or anything else. I mean, if you take the economics class, I think there's a basic political economics class that had to be taught, but personal finance was never taught.
Going back to the idea where you have to be like 22, 23 years old to get a real professional job, it's really interesting because a lot of people don't seem to think that young children have the capability of holding a professional job and have the mental capabilities of being what is perceived as professional. It's also interesting to keep in mind that in the early 1900s, when apprenticeship, and even before that, when apprenticeship was a big deal, a kid could be an apprentice to a locksmith, and by the time he's 14, 15 years old, he could run his own store.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
So,
but they call that child labor, right? But it's not child labor to stick him through a prison camp called public school where he has to write testing and everything else.
Yeah. And the involuntary aspect is huge. Like, that's something I kind of started waking up to later in my high school career. I don't remember ever being told what school's function really was, except for the fact that it's supposed to educate you and make you into this. I mean, they weren't even using deep terms as far as like self-reliance and critical thinker or anything like that. It was just like something that you had to do to become a functioning member of society. And then in school, you don't even get to question what logic is. You don't question what philosophy is. You never question the environment in which you're in. And God forbid if you ever question the teacher, because then you're disrespectful. And then you go to the office or you get your flip card flipped into red and you're labeled as this mischief type of kid.
What are these cards?
Flip cards?
Yeah.
I never heard of this?
No. I would love to learn more about this.
Okay. Well, in the elementary school I went to anyways, this was about kindergarten through fourth to fifth grade. you would sit in class, and if you did something that was labeled as bad, or you spoke out, or you were being naughty, there's three cards. So there's a green, a yellow, and a red.
Like soccer.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you would sit, like, you would be on a green card all day. If you did something bad, you would get to a yellow card, and there would be like a minor consequence for that. That was actually more of a warning. And if you got to a red card, that's when you would be sent to the principal's office. That's when you would get a detention. That's when you'd get scolded.
I wonder if, I think it'd be great if like the APA got involved, where they're like, well, if they got three red cards, that means they have oppositional defiant disorder. So they, like, it just comes with a drug. Like, you pull out your little red card and they just put a little pill on it, like Adderall.
Yeah.
There you go, guys.
Yeah. And then that just reinforces the idea of like the negative feedback loop. Because if you're like a too talkative type of kid, if you have too much energy, you're bound to get a red flip card. And then through doing that, you might be put into something like Title I, which is like a special eds class or something like that, which is what I was put into. And then later I was put into like honors classes. So it just makes no fucking sense whatsoever.
Right.
Apparently I was disabled and then I was overachiever.
Yeah.
So right. Yeah, it really has an effect on the child's mind as far as, okay, I'm getting this red flip card. I'm getting this multiple times a week. My parents are being called. There's all this negative attention around me. Something must be wrong with me.
So can we talk a little bit about when you decided to leave and how that process worked for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I decided to leave after sophomore year, right before junior year started. A couple of things led up to this, but the main things were the just overall attitudes of my peers and my teachers, namely the apatheticness towards the learning. I started to realize that I just was not interested in school. And even when I tried to be, the other kids around me were far less interested than I was. And it just led to a disregard or a resentment towards school and the system as a whole. Because the social system is, in high school, especially in the high school I went to, was very judgmental. It was very filled with predetermined beliefs of how you should act as far as like the kids. So you have to fit into a certain clique. And if you didn't fit into that clique, there was bullying that happened, even though I was never really bullied. It was not a center of learning. And I started to like really get this. And I also had a few friends, and I still do, who are a little older than me, and they were in college, and they were already on the path of self-education. So mm-hmm. when I would talk to them about the problems I was having, they were like, why don't you just get out? Why are you wasting your time? Like, you understand this is a waste of time, right? And it was really over a course of two or three conversations, long, deep conversations about this, I was, you know, it was so obvious. It's like, why am I wasting my time here?
So it happened relatively quickly.
Yes, it happened very quickly. Within a year or two of, not even a year or two, but those feelings were boiling up. And then the actual decision led down to a few conversations.
So what did you do? How did you do it?
First it took some, persuading of my mom to, and she's pretty open, but you know, coming to her and saying, I want to get out of school. I think for a lot of parents, that's pretty scary for their children to come up and say that, especially in just like the standard American mindset. So I would have a few conversations with her and she would think about it. And, you know, at this point I was really just in the mindset, like, yeah, you're my parent, but I'm going to do what I feel is right for me. So I was really taking a stand, and I really like didn't leave her with any choice, but it was more just her coming around to understanding that it wasn't helping me.
Right.
And so over the summer, I was talking to my mother between sophomore and junior year. And by halfway through, I got her okay. And we enrolled myself into online schooling, specifically ECOT. And basically online schooling is the school district, in quotations, comes and gives you a computer, and you have a certain certain amount of courses, and this is all related to the amount of points you need to graduate, and yada yada. So you basically wake up whenever you want. You can finish the courses as you please. There's like certain requirements as far as the amount of work you have to put in that week, but it's all really easy, and so like an hour a day, you'll be fine. So through this route, it gave me so much more free time to study what I wanted to study. And at that point in my life, I didn't even know what I wanted to study. I just knew that there was a lot out there that I didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually didn't grasp until I really started to look things up and listen to things like School Sucks and listen to things like Tragedy and Hope and Stephen Molyneux. I didn't understand how much was out there the school had untouched until I started to listen to these various outlets. And it, the feeling that came from that was so overwhelming for me personally, because I just felt like I wasted 10 years of my life.
Yeah.
And so that part of it can be extremely stressful.
I want to go back to something you said a minute ago about free time. And this was one of the realizations I had. I was working as a tutor after I left teaching, like between 2006 and 2008, in a really competitive area in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. where they take their public schooling very, very seriously. And it was a wealthy area, which also adds to the, you know, the competition. And I remember becoming aware of this concept of the theft of free time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I remember being in elementary school, or even for me, like being in high school and still having free time.
Mm-hmm.
But then like 10 years later, these kids have their lives so managed between school and 3 hours a night of homework,
right.
in some cases, and then extracurriculars that yeah. they can put on their college applications.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. then, you know, maybe there's a little bit of respite from that kind of schedule in college. You know, depending on the student and what they're doing and what they're studying and where they're going to school, maybe there isn't. And then for a lot of us, between commuting and working, the professional world that follows doesn't offer much free time either. And through this theft of free time, most people don't have much, you know, time available to them to think about anything.
Right.
And I've had those conversations with people like, yeah, you know, maybe the stuff you're saying is important, but I don't have time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also kind of bound to this lifestyle that my job has created. So it's not like
they're slaves to their own life.
Yeah. And that's really difficult.
Yeah. And it's also,
but that's learned is what I'm saying. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. As far as like free time goes, I can think of almost nothing more important than a individual's mental development. And it's really sad now that children, when they do have free time, they're watching, they're watching like stupid shit on TV, or they're just completely distracted by like violent video games or whatever it is. And I'm not really narking on TV or video games, but I'm like, my dilemma is, when you have this free time, why is it that these kids are not pursuing to better themselves? Why is that not a priority on their mind?
Well, it's because public education implements and institutionalizes the idea that knowledge, or trying to grasp knowledge, is a chore, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where like the summertime thing comes in. It's like, well, no, I've already learned all this stuff the entire year. You really haven't.
Right.
I mean, I by the time I was like 18 years old, I legitimately could not write there correctly. I was like, is it T-H-E-I-R? Like, I mean, that's how bad I was.
Yeah.
Right. And then I started like arguing with people online, and they were pointing this out, like, you have no writing skills whatsoever. So I went to my girlfriend at the time, and she was, you know, really into English and everything else. I was like, hey, can you teach me this? I learned everything in about a week and a half. I was mm-hmm. like, oh, okay, I got this whole thing now. Now I can write.
I fully believe that the idea of education becoming a chore is something that is learned, and is something that is really embodied in the school system's fundamental ways of carrying out so-called education. This, when I took myself out of public education, there was a period of time where I had to kind of decondition myself into like really gaining my sense of loving to learn back, really gaining that feeling back. Because as a kid, you talk to any 5-year-old and they're just full of questions. If you talk to them, they are so curious. And that's something that is just completely decimated between the ages of like 9 and 13.
And it's not even necessarily consciously done by the teachers, because the truth of the matter is that whenever we're living in smaller tribe society, things like that, you could end up having, you know, at least 2 adults per 1 kid, mainly mm-hmm. because there was a lot of infanticide and kids died at a young age. But then we enter into the school system, which is 1 teacher for like 24 kids. And they're like, the main thing that you're trying to shut off is the why question. It's, why are you listening to me
mm-hmm.
on these particular subjects? So, and then we have what is considered 21st century child abuse, which is the drugging of children in America, where we have 1 out of 6 kids or something like that on some kind of pharmaceutical drug.
Yeah, crazy.
And then women over 30, 1 out of 3 is on some kind of antidepressant.
Well, that reminds me of what you were saying before about how this pain associated with learning is learned in schools, right? So we learn to incorrectly associate school with learning. We then learn to correctly associate school with pain, but then...
And then the flip cards play into that.
Unfortunately, you know, pain with learning. And I think it's like, well, what are the values that are taught in school? What do they want? They want hard work. So hard work, when you're doing hard work, when you're working hard, you're really great in school. What are some other things that we would associate with education? Curiosity. Well, if it means questioning the rules, questioning the teacher, questioning the routines, curiosity will be discouraged. How about creativity? Creativity is fine if you're in ceramics class or you're a kindergartner finger painting. Oh, you're so creative. Mm-hmm. Pat on the head. But if your creativity involves maybe some of the same kinds of challenges, it will not be encouraged. Individuality, you know, another very important aspect of a learning experience. Is that going to be encouraged in school? Even if it's not explicitly discouraged, if you look at the whole milieu of school, it's not being encouraged from the social scene to the way academics are organized, to the way people are organized. So we're really only left with rewards for hard work. You're a hard worker. School is about making hard workers. That's what it's been about since the 1860s, you know, and now factory workers are just service workers.
Yep.
Or
utilitarian.
Or corporate employees. Yeah. But school has never done a good job with knowledge work, right? Mm-hmm. Which is why knowledge is associated. One of the reasons why, anyway, knowledge is associated with pain.
In school. The collective aspect in school is very strong. I mean, it goes back to what you were saying. The kid who gets an A is put on this gold pedestal, while the kid and everybody is supposed to aspire to be like that person. And then that person gets special treatment from the teachers. They're nicer to the teachers. They get more leniences and things like that. As far as the kid who doesn't pay attention, who's not necessarily actively engaging in the class, if as far as that can even go in school, those kids are just looked down upon. They're labeled dumb. I actually did a little interview with one of my English teachers from high school, and she was a teacher for over 40 years. And she let me in on, because I was asking her questions like, what were you learning in college, and what was your teaching career like, and how did it change throughout the years and things like that. And she let me in on that teachers, like, they had different acronyms for kids who did not learn as well, like Teach the Idiot, TTI, and things like that. So it's really, if you are not putting in that hard work, you are going to be looked down upon no matter what. And that is just like the most negative ecosystem for a mind to flourish in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you've seen what people do in order to be able to get a master's in teaching. I was just talking to a public school teacher recently who had a master's in teaching. She was like, yeah, we figured out how to, you know, make coloring boards and things like that.
But see, here's the problem, is that even if the knowledge work is not hard, the pace of the work is very frustrating. The time, the money, the bureaucratic hoops that you have to jump through. Like, are you really doing anything hard to become a teacher? Not from my experience, but I gave up on it. I mean, I was like halfway through a master's program in educational leadership, and the school I worked at said, do you want the lead teaching job? Well, I asked for it, but they offered me the lead teaching job at, you know, this whole campus. And I said, well, okay, that's what I'm going for. I'll be the lead teacher. They're ready to give me the job now. I really couldn't do both, so I dropped out and took that job in like 2002. But I was frustrated. I mean, I to be honest, I remember being like a little bit nervous about the certification exam in Massachusetts, because my secondary certification was in history, and at the same time I was trying to do like a leadership master's, and the history exam was pretty hard. When you're going through a certification exam, they're not teaching you anything about the subject you want to teach. That's like, you should have learned all this in public school, which nobody does, right? So then there's this whole other process of learning the subject that you want to teach, and learning it in a way that you're going to have to unlearn it later, you know, because it's all the same crap that you would, right. You're going to be the delivery system for the public schools. So it's not like you're really learning history. You're learning, you know, names and dates and disconnection and acausality and patriotism and nationalism and all of that. And yeah, I mean, I guess maybe it has more of a leftist slant, but that's not good either, you know, as far as like what you're going to be teaching kids about economics and who the heroes of history are. So by 2002, 2003, I was really just too frustrated, even though it was so, the work was relatively easy day in and day out. I remember we had to do a puppet show once. One of our assignments in a master's level coursework was a puppet show. It was just too much time.
You know, there's this interesting idea. Have you ever heard of the term ego depletion? Mm-hmm. So ego depletion is essentially we only have so much supposed willpower, and then after a while we start to break, right? So there was this interesting study where what they did was they had one group of people memorize three numbers. They had another group of people memorize nine numbers. And what they had to do was they had to walk to another room, right, and then repeat those numbers. So the group who had to remember nine numbers, it's a lot more difficult, so you have to think about it. And what they didn't know as part of the study was whenever they were walking halfway through the hallway, a person comes up to them, right, and states, hey, we have too much food right now. We're literally trying to give it out. Would you like some of the cake or would you like some of the fruit, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the people who had to remember only three numbers were like really, really high percentage grab the fruit because they're like, oh, I'm on my diet. I'm this thing. I should be healthy. I should do this. And you're going through all these different things in your head and you're remembering three numbers, right? So very easy. Grab the fruit. A huge percentage of the people who had to remember nine numbers grab the cake because in their mind, like 5, 6, 7, 4, 4, 4. Oh, fuck yeah, cake. Awesome.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing is you're not thinking about all the other things in regards to that. So when it comes to ego depletion, I always put that, and I don't know why more people aren't talking about this. I'll do another episode on it. But ego depletion,
interesting term.
Ego depletion when it comes to politicians, teachers, CPS workers. So the main thing is, oh, well, they just have to have the right willpower in order to be able to fight against these people on a constant basis. You know, politicians are incentivized to be evil bureaucrats. Nancy Pelosi talked about one time that she had 1,000 lunches in 1 year. So a lobbyist isn't directly allowed to give you money. Instead, you have to go to lunches. So you call lobbyists all day. It's not lobbyists who call politicians. It's the politicians who actually call the lobbyists and go, hey, I'm having this lunch. You should bring, it's only $1,000 for the lunch. And then we're expecting these politicians, like, you know, Joe Rogan to bring up, we just need strong politicians. It's like, no, the very incentive structure by which it is set up. So you're going to have ego depletion after a while. So even though the first 2 years you might have done some good stuff, after a while you start to break down. Same things happen with public school teachers. You have public school teachers who for like the first year I meet them, they're like, oh, I'm doing all these things and I'm having to fight with the administration in order to be able to do this, but I'm teaching kids. And after a while they're like, yeah, I hate kids.
Yeah,
they're
just going to burn out.
You break down, and CPS workers, the same thing. If the incentive structure is working against the enhancement of knowledge and of understanding and of growth, then after a while, of course, you're going to break. So when it comes to the teachers that we're talking about, when it comes to public school and everything else, the incentives are there to make the kids shut the fuck up so that you can lie to them for 8 hours a day for a long period of time and be able to control this rat's nest of human beings that are not your own.
Yeah, it's classroom management. I mean, so much of being certified, as I remember it, to be a teacher is about classroom management. Now, obviously, that's a euphemism, right? Because a classroom is like a bunch of desks in a concrete block room and a chalkboard or a dry erase board. And that manages itself, right? It's about the management of human beings. It's quite scientific. But yeah, the hidden lessons of school, obedience, conformity, and as kind of a result of those, I think you get apathy. And I don't think that most teachers realize that they're delivering that.
That's the really sad part, too.
A lot of
teachers, you talk to them, and they just have, like, you bring up these ideas of, like, well, don't you think that the flip cards or the testing or anything like these are negatively impacting the child's mind? And some of a lot of the teachers, they think that what they're doing is completely helpful to the kids. And if the kids don't get it, then that just means that they can't learn, that they have some type of, that something is wrong with them.
But you know, when it comes to the testing though, you know, there's these teachers who are stating, oh, well, it's because of standardized testing that there's a problem, and ignoring the history of public education, which has been problematic from the get-go. So now you have people like Glenn Beck going, look at what they're doing at Common Core. And it's like, you know, that's just one other small aspect of the continuing problem.
Mm-hmm.
So you think if we just reform it, no, the entire system is set up in order to control children. Because the best way that you can control society is by stating it's in the best interest of the kids.
Right. Yeah. It's also not seeing the state for what it is and seeing it as a whole and how it functions and how it really, like, it does not work in your interest whatsoever. So, like, trying to change the state from the inside out, trying to change society by using this institution that has a monopoly on violence that in the first place is not predicated on your well-being whatsoever. It's just absolute. It's impossible.
Brent, and I don't remember who you were interviewing, but essentially the term came up, this fear of control, mm-hmm. or this fear of influence when it comes to Stoicism. And it's about essentially whenever you try to dedicate your life to something that you have absolutely no control over, that's when suffering truly occurs.
And when it comes to your sphere of influence, it's also like one of the most important things you can do is change yourself. That's what I always advocate when I talk to people. Instead of using the political process or anything else, like you have a lot of work to do on yourself, and that's not an insult or anything, but we all have went through, especially the education system, it left us shorthanded. So the first thing you need to do, or the first thing that will be beneficial to you, is to be active in your own education. And there's this awesome book called Lies My Teacher Told Me. I don't know if you guys have heard of it or not.
James Lowen.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And for anybody who doesn't know, he was a university professor. And he actually, and correct me if I'm wrong on that, but he was a university professor. And his what he did in his book was he surveyed 12 history textbooks that are most commonly used in the U.S. And he basically surveyed them on as far as their truthfulness, and he will give each chapter goes over a different section in history. So the first one was like Christopher Columbus, and that's probably one of the most well-known lies of history textbooks and lies of public school, is that Christopher Columbus was not the first person to discover the Americas. Obviously, he was not some great savior or hero or anything like that. But the importance of the book that I found was that you really get to see how the history textbooks change history. And this also relates to George Orwell's 1984 and changing the newspaper articles and having a monopoly on learning or on knowledge. So once you identify that, like, you have been lied to, or that you have been misled, things like that, that's when you can really start to take control of your own life. That's when you can really kind of chop through the nonsense and try and find truth. And also, like, you have to up your ante on your logic and everything like that, which is hard work, but, you know, it's needed to self-educate.
The mm-hmm. chapter after Columbus, I think, is about hero worship,
mm-hmm.
right?
No, that was actually the first chapter, heroification.
The heroification, yeah. Right, right. It talks about Woodrow Wilson, and it talks about Helen Keller. And yeah. that was probably like the most valuable lesson in that book for me. I had a copy. It was filled with notes and everything was highlighted, and I had, mm-hmm. Post-its in it. And I love that book so much. But that particular chapter about hero worship was so valuable. And it actually speaks to what you were saying about the spheres of influence, right? Because I think one of the things we learn in school is that, well, there's different kinds of human beings, right? There's like human beings who can really like hold up under pressure and really do great things. And then there's you who gets to read about them.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
That's one of the reasons why people look for these political saviors, right? Mm-hmm. And somebody else is going to give me my freedom, or if they have some other kind of value system or priorities, it feels like it has to come from
something else
other than this process of self-change and mm-hmm. growth. That I thought was one of the most destructive lessons of school, and it went for everybody, mm-hmm. no matter whether you wanted a more traditional conservative view. George Washington is great. Thomas Jefferson is great. They never did anything was wrong. They certainly never owned slaves. Or even the Martin Luther King.
Or grew hemp.
right, exactly. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. Mm-hmm. Those were these sort of lone, visionary, courageous people who did things that you could never do. And it erases whole networks of people who were involved and supporting and working together mm-hmm. on the civil rights.
Right. Right.
It's just Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks.
So in trying to turn it into a more positive approach where people can, try to figure out what to do with their own life, especially if they're, say, in high school. I know Brett has an audience of actual high schoolers. For me, it's more of an audience of, other people who are dealing with child protective services. But I know there's some kids from foster homes. And like, what are some things you'd recommend for people not only to get out of high school, but kind of how to organize themselves in a way that could better benefit them?
Sure. To get out of high school, I mean, that's pretty straightforward. It's either go with an online thing so you can still get your degree, or drop out, get your GED, or just drop out and not get any of it. That's really a choice up to you and something that you'll have to consider for your own personal life. When it comes to becoming a better first you have to understand, like, why are you getting yourself out of education? Why are you giving yourself out of the public school system? And once you start to question those things, you can kind of get a direction for where you want to start going. For me, the biggest thing was I wanted to learn more. I wanted to be more keen on my intellectual knowledge and my knowledge in general, a more well-rounded person. So when it comes to like improving those aspects of my life, one of the first things I found super important to research was logic. Logic is something that was not really touched on at all in my school. And logic is essential for understanding arguments, for understanding different sides of arguments, for picking apart arguments, and for coming to truth. So when it comes to, you know, what you want to learn about, it's awesome to learn about history, and it's awesome to learn about economics, and it's awesome to learn about philosophy and all that. But really, for me, the base of my intellectual pursuits is predicated on logic. I feel that that is the most important thing that you can teach yourself, because from there, you can really shorten the time span it takes to learn these things.
How did you go about doing that? How did you know you had to do that? How did you discover that? And how did you actually go about doing it?
Absolutely. You discover pretty quickly when you are exposed to tons of new knowledge that you have no idea that was even there. Mm-hmm. And then you feel very overwhelmed just looking at it, because you don't know, you don't understand how to make sense of it, because there's all these opposing views. I've found that the world is just a huge argument. No matter what topic you go into, there's tons of different angles that people are coming at it from. So it's extremely important to be able to look at these different angles and see which one is fact and which one is important and which one actually has some type of influence over whatever you're trying to make your mind up on.
Yeah, the rules of, and understanding the actual rules of logic, I kind of learned it through things like objectivism, and allows us mm-hmm. to get a better grasp on not just stating, well, there's different views and opinions on everything. And what happens in public education is that you get relativistic, absolutist, weird authoritarian thinking, which is just very odd. It's very Kant. And then whenever you get into college, it's taught as all relativistic yet again. Yet there's somehow grading parameters. Never understood that. And by you deciding, you know, I'm actually going to try to get these tools by which to be able to understand reality, that's obviously beneficial, which is something that a lot of people are missing. As, you know, you've already mentioned before, the fact of the matter is that school doesn't teach things like logic. And there's a very, very good reason for that, right? It doesn't teach universal ethics. It doesn't teach things like libertarianism. It doesn't teach things like economics, because every single one of those different fields is antithetical to what public education is, which is mm-hmm. anti-logical, absolutist, authoritarian, while being incredibly relativistic.
Absolutely. So when coming, I agree with everything you just said. When it comes to understanding all these different opposing arguments, there's definitely some tools I found extremely useful. Something that you've shared on the show, Brett, was the brain.
Yeah.
And the brain is, I mean, I hold it as like my most prized possession when it comes to learning, besides the internet. Yeah, it's phenomenal. My girlfriend can tell you, I'll sit online for hours, and just when I'm trying to learn about a different topic, it is so nice and so much easier to learn it if you can see it physically. So if you can create this mind map and be able to see all the key terms, be able to see all the relationships and how everything is connected, that makes it so much more easier than just keeping it in your abstract mind and reading about it.
Just so I can throw this in real quick for people who sure. are not aware of it. The brain, we have not yet stated, is a program.
Oh, I think we have, haven't we?
I mentioned it was a mind mapping software, but we didn't really go too in depth.
Yeah, it's a free program that you can actually download, and it's a really amazing tool by which you can organize your thoughts and everything else. Mm-hmm. You start with one main connection, and then it looks kind of like neurosynapses moving from one category to another, and
exactly.
another category from there. You can put different links. You can also organize it with things like Evernote, which I've discussed on the show. Just so we have that kind of explained real quick before we just throwing into this topic.
There's a way to integrate it with Evernote?
Yeah, I don't know how, but what? I've read about ways to be able to be able to integrate it with Evernote.
Holy shit.
So anyway, jumping back.
Yeah, it is a way to see where the connections actually are, because you're not really making them, you're discovering them.
Mm-hmm.
And so through that discovery, it is making it more ingrained in your brain. That's what I found. I found that my memory is exponentially better when I'm talking about certain topics I just researched using the brain.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The visual aspect of it was very helpful in seeing massively complex topics. And there are some improvements that I wanted to see made to it. I would like to be able to label lines, like identifying what a connection means.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And I don't know if there was a way to do that.
There is actually a way. There's things called link types.
Okay.
So if you right click on a thought, you can click on link type and then you can type in that link. So for example, if I'm studying marijuana prohibition, mm-hmm. and there's an important figure in the 1920s and 30s named Harry J. Esslinger, and he was the head of a predecessor to the DEA. I'm not recalling the name of the institution right now, but the point is that you can link Harry J. Esslinger's Wikipedia page or whatever page you want to link with his name. And then you can right-click on the link itself, click on link type, and I can type predecessor of the DEA and things that he did. So then you can click on Harry J. Esslinger, and see, he was connected with certain people in the newspaper corporations or companies, and then you can put those link types and say that he was funded by this person or he influenced this person and they worked together.
So the brain was one tool that helps you with this. The
brain was one tool. And then it was also seeking out different, obviously, like once you get yourself out of public schools, you still want to learn. And it's still awesome to be able to have a type of mentor or some, personally, I'm a very big audio learner. I like listening to people talk about things because it makes more sense to me. And then I can recall what they said and then go research that myself. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I do is tons of colleges out there, there's alternative educational websites such as libertyclassroom.com, which I'm subscribed to, which is amazing. There's all these different types of courses out there that you can download for free and listen to in your own time. And so that's something that I do. Like, for example, like my setup is basically, I have a 160 gigabyte iPod. Mm-hmm. I have tons of podcasts, tons of lectures, audiobooks, you know, everything on this iPod. And then I also have an ebook reader, so then I have tons of PDF files. And so it really, once, you know, and then you just set up your own curriculum. If you want to learn about, for me, the first one was logic, so I wanted to learn about logic. So I wrote down on notes what logic books I wanted to read, what logic courses I had in my arsenal that I can go through. And you know, this is all very free play as well. So if I'm like learning about logic one day and then I'm not feeling it the next day, yeah. I will learn about some, you know, there's no wrongdoing in like jumping from topic to topic. Cause I think what one thing the school system ingrains is that like each, you have to learn about one thing at a time. And if you are reading like multiple books at a time, or if you're learning about multiple things at a time, it means you have some sort of like attention problem.
Yeah, you know, another thing about that too is that's kind of underemphasized in school is setting goals, right? Setting mm-hmm. personal goals. Like in school, your goals are like every 2.5 months, there's a report card, get A's, mm-hmm. you know, but you really don't. And I was thinking about this yesterday. I don't set a lot of like milestones and goals for myself. So it's hard to pursue a new, area of knowledge without some kind of end in mind. And of course, it could always be an evolution from there, but just maybe a better word than goals or finish points mm-hmm. would be milestones.
Or checkpoints.
Checkpoints, absolutely. Like this is...
Yeah, Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Work Week, it is this pretty great thing, which is setting up 3 goals.
Mm-hmm.
One really short term that's pretty easy to get to. Second one that you need to use the first goal in order to be able to accomplish. And the third goal is something a bit bigger, right? So what you do, though, is instead of just saying the goal, you outline exactly how you're going to do it. And in his book, he states, I want you to stop what you're doing right now. I want you to write them out right now. Like, that's what's good about the book. He's really big on, like, actively using these tools by which to do it. Mm-hmm. So for me, at the time, I just quit Child Protective Services, and I was like, my first goal is to buy the equipment and set it up in order to be able to do this, right? The second goal is basically be able to start doing this podcast. My second goal at the time was get Steph and Molyneux on my show, mm-hmm. right? And then my third goal was have Steph ask me to be on his show. And this, and the thing is all of those are supposed to be within a year. Now, to a lot of people, those seem like not those important of goals, but the thing is, it was a personal goal to me because Stefan Molyneux was someone at the time, and I still do, you know, really respect. And I thought, okay, well, these all branch together and you can set them up in different ways. Like, this is my podcasting goal. This is my other goal. And by doing that, you end up organizing yourself much better. And it's this kind of obsession with being able to do things that you can manage, you have a choice into, which is why Tim Ferriss is also obsessed with things like stoicism, which I've gotten more into lately, about, you know, trying to figure out those controls by which to be able to manage life so that your life isn't just continuously stressful.
Right.
And so I really like those tools by which to do it. And that's what's great about technology right now, is that it's allowing us to be able to accomplish these goals in a more meaningful way, things like organization.
Right. Yeah. And you're able to connect to bigger communities. One of the things I've been doing for a while is journaling. And by journaling, I really just mean writing down my thoughts. And I know that's a pretty broad statement, but when it comes to goal setting and long-term goals and things, I'll write down the type of person I want to be in 5 years, the type of person I want to be in 10 years. And so I will start to envision who I want to be. And then I can, and like, once you have that vision concrete, you can start to work towards that vision in a much more meaningful way. And then short-term and long-term goals are can benefit that as well. So if I want to be a educated, educated, well-rounded, level-headed, humble human being, and I want to be knowledgeable, what can I do today? What can I do like weekly basis? What can I do on a monthly basis to start to work towards that? And then also having like milestone goals. So one of my milestone goals was actually to be on School Sucks podcast. And here I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if you have these different types of goals, your brain, and you really identify them, your brain will find ways to get to it. It's like if you have your phone on the table and you want to go pick up that phone, if something's in the way, say another hand, your hand will automatically correct itself to go find that phone.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it's the same idea. It's self-directed. Your brain will work for you. The subconscious will work for you. All you have to do is really, have them concretely in your mind and work towards them actively.
Yeah, absolutely. And doing the work makes more things possible.
Absolutely.
You know, yeah. Like saying, well, I'm going to move. There's a better chance that you're going to wind up with the phone in your hand,
mm-hmm.
to reuse that. But I found that when I was diligent, you know, and I knew what I was trying to do, it seemed like more doors were open, mm-hmm. right? Because I already had that momentum going. And I think that attitude was a part of it too. We've talked about The Secret on my show before, not very positively, but when you are oriented towards positive things in life, you're more likely to find them.
Right.
You know? And when you're oriented towards more negative things, you're going to find things that fit into your comfort zone.
Right.
Well, to be fair though, that people will point out like, oh, that was a good benefit of the thing, The Secret, but it's because they didn't read The Secret.
Yeah, they don't tell
it.
You that.
They actually don't tell you that at all. It just says, think it and it will come, which is right. Fucking retarded.
Right. I think the more down-to-earth view of this, of the law of attraction or The Secret, is if you envision your goals, you envision who you want to be, and then you actually work towards those, you can move yourself towards those goals, and you can, they won't just come to you magically, but it requires a lot of your active participation, all of your active participation.
And I have an issue with aspect of public school in that the goal setting is so random and not really true. It's just like, well, learning this may or may not get you to this point. Doing this may or may not get you to this point.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than, no, there's legitimate goals. Like, I'm working on a book right now. Like, that is, to me, 6 years ago, God knows, I would have never thought, yeah, I'm going to write a book and half of it is on the history of something where almost no one else has been able to put that together, which is history of chiropractic services.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is something that has not been really well researched, and now I'm doing all this stuff by myself. By the way, I don't have a master's in history, so no, I haven't spent half my life doing menial tasks that are absolutely worthless and talking about, you know, some weird aspect of the Crusades that will only sell to other academics and no one else. But we need to close up soon here.
Sure.
We've got
absolutely.
Some time issues. But okay, so as per usual, we'll be doing more topics on this. Of course, go to truthovercomfort.net. I'm now having to get a normal job, folks, because the donations have kind of lingered a bit. So please donate to the show. It takes a lot of work to be able to do everything. Of course, schoolstartsproject.com for Brett's show.
Yep.
And you could donate to his show too. Just donate to mine first, God damn it. And Dana, is there anything you need to plug?
No, I have a few projects going on right now, but none of them are fully formed. So I will be releasing my own website and a few other things I have going on in the background. But just one little takeaway, one of the hardest things and one of the most important things that you can do when taking yourself out of public schools is changing your mindset, something that you just touched on. If you have the goals and you have the positive attitude, you will no doubt better yourself and you will no doubt create something worthwhile of your life. That's one of the most important things. Because for me, I had to shed a lot of, I had to shed the apathy towards learning. I had to shed the negative thoughts about myself and not being able to, because going through school, I felt like I wasn't learning anything. So I felt that there was a reason why I wasn't learning anything. So it's shedding all those bullshit beliefs, and it's a process, but eventually you will see improvements and, you know, you'll just get addicted to learning.
And, you know, and I think a good way to end is, you know, I was bringing up earlier, the three best ways to get into the middle class is finishing high school, keeping your first job for a year, and not having a kid until you're married. I agree with number three, but I think the other aspects are, you know, try to get some kind of self-esteem, you know, work on those kind of things, learn about critical thinking and living consciously and learn the rules of logic, and then actually try to achieve goals in your own life that are more than just necessarily making money. But of course, we also don't want a bunch of really smart libertarians who are simply working at Starbucks for their entire life. So financial freedom can also be another aspect of freedom as a whole, and that is incredibly important. And on that note, folks, thank you very much. Subscribe to the show on iTunes. We're also on Stitcher, of course. So do all the good things and have a nice day. Or you know what? Don't fucking do any of them and do whatever you want and just keep on clicking on reviews.
Yeah, fuck you.
Fuck you. Go fuck your mother. All right, folks. All right, I love you all very much and I'll see y'all later. And nobody lives forever, no one at all. So hush your anchor. Push your